Hello and welcome to Theatre Voice. I'm Sophie Reynolds and I'm here at the Queen's Theatre in Hornchurch, where I'm going to be speaking to Glenn Wolford, who is currently directing a new production of The Merchant of Venice. And also with us are a couple of members of the cast. We've got Matt Devitt, who's playing Shylock, Stuart Organ, who's playing Antonio, Dominic Gerard, who's playing Bassanio, and Josie Taylor, who plays Portia. So, Glenn, why don't we just start off with the very beginning of the first act, first scene. What do people see in this production when the lights go up?
Well, they see a Wheel of Fortune portrayed as a casino, as a roulette wheel, basically. Make of it what you will. I mean, my overall vision for the whole play, really, which nobody's particularly picked up on, but that's nonetheless important to me, is the Wheel of Fortune, both in classical terms, the goddess of fortune, which is more than luck, I mean, it's destiny in a way, and the gambles that people take on a casino wheel. It's absolutely rife, really, in Merchant of Venice to me, in that everybody gambles, and they gamble big, including Portia's dead father. I mean, he gambled, they all gamble. And that you know, I found that really exciting, because I'm a bit of a gambler myself, so... So that was a way I wanted to show a very hedonistic crowd of Venetians obsessively gambling on this wheel. And then, of course, the music hopefully adds to that crazed, glorious nonsense of gambling. And, of course, they're gambling with the ducats that we use all the way through. And then, of course, the crash of the music, and wallop, we're into Shakespeare's text. And immediately... we start to get into the real souls of the characters themselves, I hope. What we also have to do, and it's vital to me, is that our audience here are a real mixture. You know, some of whom do know Shakespeare, some bit know it, and quite a lot don't know it at all. And very, very many don't know Merchant of Venice. So it's very, very important that the language you create and the atmosphere that is created, they are able to relate to the world that is being uncovered. So that's the way I wanted to start, by letting them into a world and sharing it with them, which is a vital thing to me, without patronising them, but actually telling a tale clearly and hopefully intriguingly.
And the first character that we meet is Antonio. And yes. I always think that's a really interesting opening, because it's... And he's basically starts off the whole play by saying, "Oh, I'm feeling a bit sad." It seems like an interesting way to kick start a play, really. It's not the most obvious line. How do you think?
It's comedy.
Yeah.
Well, exactly. How do you deal with that?
Well, in rehearsal, you have to make a decision on why you think he is sad, and this has to be agreed eventually with the director and the actors, and you make your decisions, but it is an interesting conundrum, and it's an interesting way to start a play. And playing the first line is, I think it's the first time I've ever actually had the first line in a Shakespeare play, is actually quite daunting, because it's important to let everything settle. And so you tend to actually approach it, well, I do anyway, quite slowly, and there's a certain stylized note to the production, which also has to be incorporated, so things have to be placed, and you have to give the audience time to get their ear in, really, to the verse. So all that sort of going on in the first lines of the play, which make it quite interesting to play, interesting to rehearse, and interesting to play. And you know, you make the decisions, they're right decisions or they're wrong decisions, but it's setting a tone. And it's introducing your character, and it's meeting other characters on stage, obviously, all for the first time. And I think that most audiences have to be given a certain amount of leeway. I'm not talking about patronising them, not at all, but have to be given a certain amount of leeway just to adjust their ear and get into the tone and the pace of the piece. And I think you're doing a bit of all of that with the opening lines.
Yeah, so you've got a lot to achieve.
There's a lot going on early on, yeah.
Yeah, and you're setting up relationships. So the first relationship, we've got Antonio and Bassanio. So what happens there?
Well, that's very complicated. I think from Bassanio's point of view, he is totally naive about Antonio's feelings for him. and not really very interested at the same time, because what he ultimately wants is to have the means, the money from Antonio to go and woo Portia properly. And he does care very much about Antonio, and I think he sort of grows up a bit throughout the course of the play and begins to face up to what he has with Antonio. And certainly Portia becomes very aware of it and has to actually sort that out, because I think later on, I don't know how far I can speak later on, it's not still the first act, but later on she has to test him, I think, with the episode at the end with the rings, about giving away the rings, as a way of really making sure he affirms his love for her and is free of Antonio. So I think from Bassanio's point of view, he probably sees Antonio as a bit of a father figure, but the way I see it, I don't know, but I would think from Antonio's point of view, it's a little bit more than that in terms of his feelings for Bassanio. I don't know what...
Yes, I'd agree with that. There's a lot of unrequited love there. Yeah.
I think the text points to that, actually. I don't think it's... And I also, you make the parallel also, Antonio and Sebastian in Twelfth Night. I think it's very significant. The same character name, in fact, in the same relationship there between the older man and the younger man.
Yeah, and there's also a parallel, I think, maybe between the first scene and the second scene, where you have, firstly, Antonio, who perhaps maybe has feelings for Bassanio, and then Portia, who says a very similar thing, really, when she opens her scene.
It's quite interesting, isn't it? And is immediately kind of Neris is like, I mean, come on. You've got all of this wonderful... I mean, really, madam? And she's like, well, fine. Because she's just this wonderful mix between sort of goddess of the world and just very real and humorous and, you know, doesn't really take herself too seriously at times. This whole first scene is just... It's a bit of a gift, really, in terms of getting to really love the character, because you have to really be on board with Portia. So Shakespeare's written this fantastic double act between Nerissa and Portia, where Nerissa sort of sets him up and Portia knocks him over. All of this stuff with the suitors, you know, it's brilliant to play.
Is that something that is also rather difficult to play? Because the thing with the suitors is rather a set-up situation.
Well, in terms of, I mean, I guess the challenge could be that Portia could be seen as this kind of bratty, spoilt little girl who all these men are kind of falling over their feet to be with, and she's just sitting there taking the piss out of them. It could come across as a little bratty and spoilt. But I think, I don't know, I think actually it was quite interesting. We made quite a big choice, didn't we, that Morocco was the first suitor who'd actually decided to go ahead with the challenge, because all of these suitors, you know, haven't actually had the welly to go through with it once they find out the conditions. So, I mean, that old adage of things happening on stage the first time being more interesting. So actually, up until this point, you had no contact with the caskets, in our production at least, that's, you know, so that's yet to come.
Yeah, and that's,
you know,
the
first. It's still game time, it's still courtship time, it's still sitting on the love seat, having awkward conversations with foreign blokes. So it's not, you know, it hasn't got the same gravitas, I guess.
Sure, and that is the first gamble, I suppose, that takes place in the play.
Exactly.
The first gamble, really, is him saying, go and see.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Go and see what you can do with the fact that I don't have any money at the moment.
Yes.
And see if you can get the equivalent of 500,000 grand out of somebody. That's one hell of a gamble. And his gamble, of course, is that he's going to do this huge venture anyway. And, cast himself into a totally unknown area of behaviour. No, that's the first gamble, is his gamble. Then the second gamble, which is referred to, of course, is the father's gamble with the caskets. You know, actually, they have to have faith that he's right, that somehow this mystic, she calls him a holy man, and I've always read that as, you know, some wondrous weirdo guru who believes in this level of gambling and believes in the Wheel of Fortune and believes in destiny. But it's still a gamble. The fact that she has faith in it when she's so bright, and a touch bratty, I think she is bratty in many ways, you know, which is fine, you know, it's a spoiled princess, really, but a very funny one, you know, and a very, very...
self-aware.
Very well, self-aware in as well, but also non-self-aware, which makes her intriguingly interesting and wild. But that's another gamble. I mean, it's gamble after gamble after gamble, really. And the more you uncover it, the more gambles there are. And then, of course, this is gamble.
Exactly. So, enter Shylock.
Pursued by a bear.
Looking like a bear.
How did you approach the character? Or with that first entrance, how did you feel? Because you obviously have to relate to the audience in some way. And they have to feel something about you when they first see you.
Yeah. It's difficult to talk solely about the first scene without talking it as generally. And obviously, I think The Merchant of Venice is sometimes considered a problem play because of its perceived anti-Semitism. And as far as I'm aware, it was probably written as a classic. There is a school of thought that says that actually Shakespeare sat down originally to give it to the Jews, and being Shakespeare with his great humanity and compassion and intelligence, couldn't possibly write a non-three-dimensional character. And some of the speeches later in the play have obviously become classics because of that multifaceted character that he produced. So you don't want to over-sentimentalise him because you don't want... I mean, I didn't, sorry, you could do. I don't want to, let him off the hook, really. But I think we decided early on, and this goes back to when Glenn and I first took, and I was flabbergasted when she asked me to play Shylock, was that you're not diluting the drama of it if you actually show his humanity and a bit of his humour in that, while still maintaining this idea that he does hold a grudge. Now, there's a great deal of rational explanation for this grudge, but I think a lot of it with him is whilst it's absolutely, his Jewishness is absolutely essential, I think as a character, you have to treat him also as an individual. And there are other things going on in his head that are completely conflicting. Mm. So it's you can't necessarily say, I'm not a good enough actor to say I try and play a different line every night, but you do try and say, this idea of making decisions, keep them a little bit nebulous, keep them a little bit not particularly firmed up about exactly why. Because we as people, we as humans, every day make decisions. We go, why did I do that? That doesn't seem in character. Why did that happen? Or so that for that first entrance, it's, again, going back to Stuart's point, I do sort of try and take it reasonably slow, and the way Glenn's blocked it as well is I'm far downstage and try and contact the audience on a fairly fundamental level early on and bring them into your world so that hopefully at the end of it they may not condone what you do or necessarily even sympathise, but they will understand entirely why you've done that.
It's an interesting point about talking about the top of the play from that point of view, because actually, obviously, this is our first meeting on stage. We're with Bassanio too, but it's the first time Antonio meets Shylock on stage, and you learn in the process of the scene a bit of the quite a lot of the history of their history of what's been going on, but the audience don't necessarily know that in the opening exchanges. So you have to make things sort of, you have to bear in mind everything that's been going on when you have those first opening exchanges together on stage. They all have to be there, even though the audience only actually learn about them as the scene progresses.
But what is horrific, and has always been horrific for me, is the level of abuse that this seemingly upstanding, moral person, highly respected person, has heaped upon Shylock. He's kicked him, he's spat at him, he's called him dogs and everything under the sun. I mean, it's just he'd be in jail if he did that today. It's extraordinary, and that's what he's done: spat on his beard and
what Glenn's also done. We've done. I mean, I'm not saying it's entirely original, but the idea feels it though. It's that when Antonio turns up in the Shylock thing, we play it as though he the last thing he expected, Antonio expected, was for this rather innocent Bassanio to end up going to his sworn enemy.
Of all the people
in Venice he could borrow money from, he's come to this one. So he's faced in the immediacy of that moment, in that scene, at scene three, with having to, from Antonio's point of view, go, I love the boy, he's on some money, I said I would, but he's here, how are we going to play this?
And to make it worse for Antonio, the way we play it is that Bassanio thinks Shylock's wonderful. he's immediately enchanted by this sort of exotic kind of Hebrew man, and obviously Antonio will hate that, because they're sitting together and they're joking around and finding things funny. Yeah,
he gets furious, and then he loses it, basically, in that very early scene.
So I think, from Bassanio's point of view, he's like the audience, he doesn't know anything of the history between Antonio and Shylock, because Bassanio just doesn't understand the world, actually, in that way. He's very sort of naive. I think he's very good-natured. He thinks very highly of everybody that he meets and gets himself into all manner of scrapes because of it, you know.
Dominic Bace's character, which on a young Labrador puppy, and that just kills me. I just think that's absolutely right. You know, this wide-eyed enthusiasm and utter guilelessness about the way human beings carry on, especially, you know, to watch these two in that very early scene and him sort of sitting there hearing this horrific stuff that that Shylock says Antonio's done to him, and think, oh gosh, really, you know, still desperately wanting that money whatever, and then being amused by Father Christmas here with his great tales of strange sheep shagging stuff, and you know, it's just the most glorious threesome on stage, I think.
Yeah. And does that relate also to Bassanio's relationship with Portia?
Oh, Bassanio's relationship with Portia.
That's skipping beyond Act One, but we've got the seeds of it sown already.
Okay. What do you mean necessarily?
Well, the rather innocent, wide-eyed enthusiasm.
And how appealing that is to Portia. Mm. Well, I mean, we have these other suitors, which, you know, really, it could have been so much worse. I mean, it's such a delicate thing, isn't it?
Yes. I think he's totally great.
I think he's utterly fantastic for Portia. Yeah, exactly. This Labrador kind of energy for someone
it's
like
energy,
Portia.
It's energy, it's fun.
And I think it's sex as well. And it's, you know, having been this sort of bird in a glass cage, you know. You see the most of the first act, Portia's kind of, particularly the way we've set it, she's, you know, in this sort of little bubble, and to be released from that and to have someone that she can, you know, spar with and act with and exercise her wit with and all of that stuff. Absolutely, I think. Especially I think they're a great match.
Through this bravado adamant character suddenly invading Belmont, I just think it's impossible to resist.
Oh, yeah. The way she sort of jumps on him in the moment,
of course.
There, it's like, yes, this is the one.
Let's talk about that, Liz. Let's talk about the setting, because that's obviously interesting and different. Tell us what exactly you've done.
Well, I moved backwards in my imagination on this one. I mean, from beginning, very, very much wanting the Casino and the Wheel of Fortune, and really wanting the Wheel of Fortune at the end. But a lot of directors of Merchant of Venice take all the urban stuff or the Venice atmosphere, and they kind of forget that at the very end, or they don't sort of work it out, that you're going to the natural Shakespeare harmony, the redemptive quality of the very end, when everything moves to the knowledge that these people are in a vast universe and how they are placed in that universe and coming to terms with what they've done and who they are and how they are in relation to this vast cosmos with its spheres, like the Lorenzo speech, for instance. So really, about two-thirds of the set disappeared as we were evolving it. It was a pragmatic decision because it was too expensive as well. But thank God in many ways, because we got the transparency of the set and the rather wonderful way that the lighting can transform that set into wherever you want, with a hint of Venice, with the domes and that, but also the hint of nature with the greeny, bluey effects and the lighting, which shows these extraordinary things in the sky that could be talking to us. That was incredibly important to me. We did have a sort of Rialto bridge at one stage that was supposed to be for the musicians and the band. That got heave-hoed for money, but it's a jolly good job it did, because the actors would have been clobbering up and down stairs and there would be no chance of the seamlessness of the actor band, you know, coming to take their positions. And I'm still I get irritated by some of the boots clomping on the stage. I would have gone utterly crazy. If it hadn't been axed before we started, it would have been axed before the technical. Well, it would have been axed at the technical, probably, because, of course, you don't see these things until you get there. It would have been impossible to handle. So, again, what you're getting from me is a mix of hopefully imaginative inspiration and sheer pragmatism about the setting. That's what you get. And it's the same with the costumes. The costumes are a deliberate mix of the Adamant and the early 80s New Romantics and the absolute disciplined classicism of the way Antonio and Shylock dress. And it's amazing how some people have got confused by the costumes when it's been done for years and years and years. So that was quite weird to me that people said they were confused by the costumes, because the costumes are exactly as I wish them to be and exactly as they're supposed to be, is relevant to all ages, but with this sort of bravado youths in their New Romantics gear strutting their stuff. And then the discipline, the absolute discipline of the guys who are a bit more grown up.
And Nerissa and I in our knickers.
And William Shakespeare and you in your knickers.
It's very clear that scene two should be played
in knickers. Played in knickers, as he was, yes.
Very clear.
Yes, he was very clear about having hot stuff at the end. Well into that, you know. I just got an email from him the other night saying that that was exactly what he meant about the whole sexual aspect in the last scene was, of course, leading up to I want some hot stuff
tonight.
And
he's had to wait centuries for this.
Yeah, nobody else has had the bottle to do that.
Let's talk about music in the first act, which is a little bit more normal, shall we say.
Sober?
But a little bit more sober. What's your attitude to working with music in a Shakespeare play? How does it fit together?
I can't do without it. Mm. I mean, to me, he's a musician, Shakespeare, and he writes the most brilliant lyrics for every play. I mean, he only wrote the one lyric for this, which I think was a bit remiss of him, which is "Tell me where is fancy bread." But the quality of the scenes just absolutely, I think, can be underpinned and really heightened by the music. I mean, Carol and I, we argued quite a lot and devolved quite a lot, during the preparation for it. But all I knew at the very beginning was that I wanted hot stuff at the end. but then I realised that I also wanted at the beginning, I wanted this utterly Led Zeppelin style clash of hedonism and chaos, which you get from Las Vegas, Macau, all these places I have haunted very happily in my life. The real chance and the real kind of turbulence of the mind, and I really, really wanted that. I also very much wanted the atmosphere of Shylock's world, with his closed, almost Victorian, rather spooky house, and the vibes of his soul to be enhanced by music. And I feel that, and the same as Belmont, going into the Belmont
magical
scene
Belmont.
With the magical kind of, the feeling of nature as opposed to, the crowded and the bustling city of Venice was really very, very important to me. And I think she's achieved tremendous stuff with the actors, who are incredible musicians. I mean, it just takes your breath away that it's possible to cast a company of such extraordinary musicians who can do all that. I think it's amazing.
Lovely. We're about to wrap it up. Does anyone have any favourite lines from the first act that you want to share?
I wish we'd been prepped for this question.
Well, I actually found myself, I think a good Shakespeare line is one that you find yourself using as wisdom in your everyday life. Like Hamlet says, there is nothing good or bad, only thinking makes it so. And the one I keep using is my line from, obviously, the top of scene two, which is, I can easier teach 20 what were good to be done than be one of the 20 to follow mine own teaching. It is a good divine that follows his own instructions. Come on.
People do use that. They colloquialise it, but they still use the essence of that now, which they do with all Shakespeare's lines.
Absolutely.
Perfect, lovely. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
And therefore disregard all of what we've just said. Okay.